Trials are meant to bring clarity. A search for truth played out in front of 12 strangers sworn to judge only what they're shown. But in reality, juries only hear part of the story. Rules of evidence, legal strategy, and courtroom procedure all shape what is presented and what is left out. And that's no different in the case against Travis Rudolph. The jury listened to hours of testimony, examined the evidence, and delivered their verdict based on what the law allowed them to see. In this extra 13th Juror episode, we're stepping outside the jury box to explore the pieces the jury never saw, the context, the complications, and the contradictions that didn't make it past the bar. And as we lay out what was hidden from view, we're left to wonder, does what we didn't see strengthen the verdict or shake its foundation? The prosecution says it was vengeance. The defense says it was survival. But it's the jurors who have the final say. I'm Brandi Churchwell, and this is 13th Juror. Today's episode is Florida versus Travis Rudolph, Part 3, Beyond the Jury Box. Before Travis's trial began, there was a hearing that could have stopped everything in its tracks. Travis Rudolph's legal team argued that he should be immune from prosecution under Florida's Stand Your Ground law. They claimed he had a legal right to use deadly force to protect himself and his home. Over the course of 4 days, witnesses took the stand, evidence was presented, and the judge, not a jury, was asked to decide whether the case should move forward at all. In his ruling, Judge Jeffrey Gillen acknowledged that most of the state's witnesses were problematic for their case, and that their testimonies were insufficient to assist the state in meeting its high evidentiary burden. He also said that Keyshawn Jones' testimony was largely not credible, and that Dominique invoked the confrontation by utilizing irrational, irresponsible, and inexcusable language. But despite all of that, in the end, the judge denied the motion and ruled that the Stand Your Ground law didn't apply. He listed several reasons why he denied the motion, including that none of the original aggressors fired any shots, that Travis shot 39 rounds, and the car turned to leave. Judge Gillen said the appearance of continuing danger was not so real that a reasonably cautious and prudent person would have believed the danger could be avoided only through the use of deadly force. And just like that, the case headed to trial. But here's the thing. The jury didn't know there had already been a full hearing with testimony from the same witnesses that would eventually testify again, long before opening statements ever began. And that's just the beginning. This case captured national attention. A former NFL player charged with murder, a Stand Your Ground defense, and a story that was anything but straightforward. As the trial unfolded, much of what happened behind the scenes remained a mystery to the jurors and the public. But we are lucky enough to get a rare glimpse behind the curtain because I sat down with Travis's defense attorneys, Mark Shiner and Heidi Perlet, who opened up about their strategy, what was at stake, and revealed information that was completely unknown before. It's the kind of insight most people and the jury never get to hear. One of the most mysterious moments of the trial involved a hidden witness. Even though the proceedings were live streamed, when this witness took the stand, the cameras went dark. No video, no audio, just silence that sparked plenty of speculation about who was in that witness box and why their identity was concealed. I asked Mark Shiner what was going on, and he told me, despite being called by the prosecution, this hidden witness ended up delivering one of the most powerful moments for the defense.
The jury could see him, but they couldn't see his face either. Obviously, they just saw the full ski mask, the sunglasses, the hat. But boy, he was the first responder, and he was so hyped up. He said, I passed the car. I'm looking for it. He was a road patrol officer at the time, going north, and the car was southbound. He made a U-turn, and he knows the city. He could not find this car. And he said there was tons of other cops going by the area. Nobody could find it. And then he makes a U-turn and he passes by it. And then he said, I passed by it and I realized there was two silhouettes by the fence behind the car, or in front of the car rather, silhouettes by the fence area. And I backed up and I pull in the driveway, and he's testifying like I'm doing. He said, I jumped out of the car, said, you guys need help? And that's when they finally said they need help. He said, I didn't understand it. I couldn't believe it. He said, if it was me, I'd be jumping down. Hey, 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 hey. This is the way he testified. He said, these two guys didn't say a word until I pulled in and said, do you need police assistance? And that's when they said, my friend got shot.
Wow. It definitely seems like there's something suspicious there. The fact that the two men didn't flag down police, even though their friend was shot and bleeding out, raises a lot of red flags. And speaking of unanswered questions, who is Hacksaw? That name popped up in court, but with no explanation. All we know is that Tyler Robinson texted Hacksaw, or Hack, with Travis's address. And beyond that, crickets. The jury had zero context. So, naturally, I asked Mark Shiner about it. And what he told me really caught me off guard.
Unfortunately, I just got his name right before the trial was supposed to start in February. And a couple of days before the trial, they give me a thumb drive with millions of documents in there from my client's phone and Tyler Robinson's phone. I could still be looking at it today for the next year if I really wanted to. They're piling on more documents, millions of documents, 2 days before trial. So then it gets continued until May. And I find out about this guy named Hack, who I know his real name, and ran a criminal background check, and he does have a criminal background. And there's other videos we have showing possibly another person walking around the crime scene that the police never found. I just couldn't tell who it was, so I didn't bring it out. There's many other things. There's a car driving away on Jasmine, the block where this incident happened. Drives away after this happens. My investigator is phenomenal. Ralph Marston's great. He found doorbell cams, ring cams that the police never bothered checking.
The defense had evidence suggesting someone else might have been at the scene, and it could very well be Hacksaw. And according to Mr. Shiner and Ms. Perlet, the prosecution held on to that evidence for 2 years and didn't turn it over until just days before the trial. The kind of behind-the-scenes detail that jurors never knew raises fundamental questions about how this case was handled. And that wasn't the only issue with the evidence in this case. Mr. Shiner told me something shocking about the lead detective, Emily Vanderlyn.
I received what allegedly Detective Vanderlyn received, and I hope she sent me everything Ring gave her. Originally, the city cameras, she only gave a portion of them, and she cut it off, and she admitted that in deposition and trying to get the full story here. So I had to fight to get everything because she edited things, and that I've never seen before.
Yeah.
But she didn't have any part of the cameras, I don't believe. So I don't think she had a chance to edit those or do anything.
That's not just concerning. It's outrageous. The idea that a lead detective would change evidence before the defense ever saw it, that shakes the foundation of a fair trial. If the information being passed to one side is filtered or manipulated, how can justice possibly be trusted? But as it turns out, Travis's case might not be the only one affected by Detective Vanderlyn's handling of evidence. At the time, she was still a rookie, and this was only her third case as a lead detective. According to both Mr. Shiner and Ms. Perlet, one of her previous cases didn't just face challenges, it ended up getting dismissed entirely. And when I heard why, I was stunned.
There has been another development that we recently learned of involving another attorney. I don't know if this was shared with you guys or not, but Detective Vanderlyn, Travis was her third case as lead homicide detective. The second case in which she was lead, we recently learned, was dismissed shortly after the Travis Rudolph case. There was apparently some evidence that she had withheld from the defense for many, many months, which exonerated the defendant, and it was also a first-degree murder case.
Withholding evidence that could have cleared someone of murder isn't just a procedural mistake. It's a fundamental violation of a defendant's rights. And to hear that this same detective played a central role in Travis Rudolph's case raises real questions about what the jury wasn't told and what kind of patterns may have gone unchecked. As Mr. Shiner put it, the lead detective is the captain of the ship. Everything flows from their decisions. In this case, he believes Vanderlyn rushed to judgment. Travis was arrested quickly before a full investigation was conducted. Travis had no prior record and posed no immediate threat. So Mr. Shiner says a few extra days of investigation couldn't have hurt and might have resulted in a very different story. But instead, that early decision shaped the entire case. And once the arrest was made, the prosecution backed it without question. To me, it seems like no one cared enough to stop and ask whether or not they got it right. And if that isn't bad enough, Mr. Shiner said Vanderlyn, who is supposed to be objective, also seemed to advocate for the witnesses from the beginning. During his cross-examination of her, Mr. Shiner brought up Tyler Robinson lying to police about having a gun.
It was crazy. It was not even believable. Instead of just admitting that she may have made some mistakes and she's human and she's a new detective, she's fighting me tooth and nail on every single issue. She just lost credibility, in my opinion, from the jump. As soon as she gets on the witness stand, it's like, who's going to believe this lady? She's not keeping it real. She's just making up stories and talking. I meant it in closing argument. I didn't use any notes. Everything I spoke was from my heart. I think this lady was just doing double and triple talk, and she's not going to fool 12 intelligent people. Jurors are smart, and they picked up on it.
There were other issues with Vanderlyn as well. For one, she made a comment that she doesn't go looking for evidence if she doesn't know it exists. Y'all, that's kind of the opposite of what a detective's job is, right? Oh, and when the topic of guns came up, Vanderlyn was asked about Keyshawn purchasing multiple firearms and selling them for a dollar to other people, which is illegal. Her response? She said she can't check things like that because there's no gun database. Mr. Shiner says that's simply not true. And speaking of guns, remember the canine unit that followed Tyler's blood trail and ended up finding his gun? Well, Mr. Shiner also gave us some insight into that situation. And y'all, I was floored.
The reason they went to look for that gun, they weren't looking for a gun, to be fair. They called Agent McMichael with the drug dog because Tyler gave him information, this didn't come out in the trial, that there was a guy with a white shirt chasing him, which DJ had the white shirt on, Travis had none. So they thought DJ had a gun. They were trying to get more evidence against DJ, and then when they found the gun and they looked it up and they realized it was bought by Keyshawn at a gun store, and now the gig is up, they go to Tyler's house the next day, and of course he's going to have to say it's his, otherwise it's Keyshawn's, and he sold it to him. So that's how that came about. It was not to go look to be fair and impartial. It was, let's go get DJ and find out it's his gun, and it turned out it wasn't his.
I guess that's just another example of tunnel vision. Once they locked in on Travis, everything else took a back seat. The problems with the lead detective were significant. But what may have been even more damaging for the prosecution was something they couldn't control: their own witnesses. And that's a topic that Mr. Shiner and Ms. Perlet did not hold back on. Jurors aren't allowed to look up witnesses or scroll through their social media. But if they could have, they might have seen a very different version of the people who took the stand. Picture after picture of Keyshawn, Sebastian, and Tyler with guns, holding their hands in what a gang expert confirmed are gang signs, and flashing stacks of money, even though they were all unemployed. There's also a post on a social media account that appears to be Dominique's, offering $1,000 on someone's head and requesting someone produce a tooth as proof. A terrifying thought, especially since this seems eerily similar to her threats against Travis. Dominique's social media is also flooded with memes and images about wanting to be spoiled by a rich man, and Travis's attorneys believe she thought she was going to get that with Travis once he made it back to the NFL. Ms. Perlet handled Dominique's cross-examination, And she said she knew Dominique would be a train wreck because of how she acted during the Stand Your Ground hearing. And while that may have been expected, I don't think anyone could have predicted this from Dominique.
Oh, get this. Here's a story y'all don't know. After she testified, she sat down in the front pew with the prosecutors and we took a break. And she had the nerve, well, the prosecutors had the nerve through her asking to talk to Travis. This lady's been posting from day one. She wants him to get the death penalty, all kind of social media things about how he needs to die. And
oh
now
gosh.
She's there wanting to talk to him. And Heidi said, no chance. I'm not going to tell you her words, exact words, but she said no chance.
I asked Ms. Perlet exactly what she said to Dominique when she asked to talk to Travis.
I sort of leaned in and gave her the death stare. She was seated at the time, so I stood, and I'm not a small woman, but I stood over her and looked her in the eyes, and I said, why the F would I ever let somebody talk to my client who wanted to put him on death row? And she looked at me with daggers like she wanted to kill me, and then I just very calmly walked away.
That takes audacity. And just when I thought we'd heard it all, Mr. Shiner and Ms. Perlet dropped another bombshell. Remember how Dominique never told Travis she was married? Well, there's more to that story. According to Ms. Perlet, Dominique was married at the time, but not just to anyone. Her husband was an inmate at the Federal Chrome Detention Center when they tied the knot. And he had a serious criminal history, some of which were violent offenses. The marriage didn't last and ended just a couple of months after Travis's arrest. Overall, in my opinion, the prosecution's witnesses in this case were a mess. Mr. Shiner and Ms. Perlet admit they've never seen anything like it.
And I think that goes to the point that I think everybody saw loud and clearly that there was no reasonable likelihood of conviction in this case. The civilian witnesses were a joke. I have never seen anything like it in my entire career. 30 years of practice. It was comical. It was a circus.
Yeah.
It was indignified. It was despicable.
Yeah.
I mean, for witnesses to be that out of control, making objections
yes.
on their own behalf, and
yes.
then telling the judge, I'm not answering her questions anymore, or his questions anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a three-ring circus. I had never seen anything like it.
While it may have come across as a circus at times, Ms. Perlet admits that she didn't mind. It's actually part of the defense's strategy to let the jury see the witnesses for who they really are. This is an idea that she refers to as a runaway witness and says when it happens, she often looks at the jury's reactions. Both attorneys told me that the jurors seemed to discount what some of the witnesses said and often didn't even look at them on the stand. There were times, however, when Ms. Perlet wanted to make sure the jurors were paying attention. For example, this moment during Tyler Robinson's cross-examination.
Every time that there was a mention of a gun other than the one that Tyler had, he could not answer my questions and look me in the eye. He put his head down, his eyes went down, and I noticed it over and over and over. And there were times that the jurors weren't looking at him, so I knew they weren't getting it. And at one point I said, why do you look down every time that I talk about you having a gun? And I got reprimanded a little bit from the judge because it wasn't a question, it was a comment. But yeah. I just felt like I had to comment on that to bring the jurors around so that they would be more attentive and start watching him that. Because it's those sort of things that, those subtle things that are huge. If
yeah.
you have nothing to hide, you look that person right in the eye and you answer him. You don't put your eyes down.
The prosecution already had credibility issues with their witnesses, but that didn't stop them from trying to add another one in the middle of trial. According to Mr. Shiner, the state notified the defense that they planned to call Sebastian's sister as a witness after the trial had already started. That's unusual. Supposedly, she was going to testify that Sebastian often held his phone in the same death grip position his hand was found in when he died. The problem? Sebastian's phone was in the trunk of the car, nowhere near his hands. Maybe that detail caught up with them because in the end, she was never called to the stand. While the prosecution struggled with credibility issues and last-minute witness changes, the defense leaned on something far more grounded. The people who knew Travis best, his family. And of course, Travis himself. The Rudolphs took the stand with calm, consistent, and compelling testimony. And their presence brought a level of clarity the jury hadn't seen up to that point. Their accounts didn't just support Travis's version of events. They humanized him. In a case full of chaos, their voices were steady, honest, and, according to the defense, absolutely essential to the outcome of the trial. As vital as the Rudolph family's testimony was, one moment nearly didn't happen. Travis's mom was struggling, emotionally and mentally, and almost couldn't take the stand.
Every time I would talk to her, she would bust down in tears and cry, and I was so devastated by what happened. I said, "Mom, you gotta listen." And I called her mom. "Your son's looking at life in prison. You'll never hug him again. You'll never kiss him. He'll never fulfill his dreams. He'll never get married. You won't have any grandchildren from him." I said, "This is real serious." I said, "You gotta try your best. I know it's devastating," but I kind of yelled at her a little bit and said, "We only have one chance to do this. Only one shot. You have to tell the truth."
Yeah.
And then she starts thinking. A few days later, she says, "Mark, I'm ready." I didn't believe her. I didn't think she had it in her because she was so emotionally distraught. And this was a miracle. This was a miracle from God that she was able to do it. And I said, "All you have to do is tell the truth." And I didn't go over her testimony with her. There was no reason to. I mean, I just needed her to go out there and say what happened.
In the end, Linda Rudolph made the emotional decision to testify and tell her story to the jury. Her courage and strength were on full display, creating one of the most powerful moments of the trial. Not far behind was Travis's brother, DJ. When he took the stand, his calm demeanor and clear testimony added another layer of credibility. But the one moment that stood out to me most was when DJ actually paused and asked the judge if he could address the jury directly. Because of the rules of court, he wasn't allowed to. But I had to know, what did he want to say? I asked Mr. Shiner.
Yeah, he wanted to talk more about the case and his feelings about it. And I said, "You can't do that. You can only answer questions." As you can tell later on social media, DJ has a lot to say. DJ has held in for 2 years. He's been busting at the seams to talk. He wants people to know his brother saved his life.
DJ was eager to tell the jury and the world just how proud he was of his brother. But he also didn't hold back when it came to describing the abuse he witnessed Travis endure from Dominique. During the Stand Your Ground hearing, DJ testified that when Dominique hit Travis on the head with the Patron bottle, she hit him so hard, DJ genuinely thought she was trying to crack his skull. During his own testimony, Travis made an offhand comment that maybe he deserved to be hit because he was talking to another girl. Unsurprisingly, prosecutors latched on to that moment. In their closing arguments, both prosecutors told the jury that Travis admitted he deserved it. That argument is controversial to say the least and sends a dangerous message, suggesting that violence is justified under certain circumstances could actually discourage survivors from ever coming forward. And let's be clear, no one deserves domestic violence. I asked Mr. Shiner about all of this, and he told me he hadn't realized how bad the abuse was until it all came out in court.
And I really even told Travis when during breaks, I said, "I didn't realize what a bad man you were." I said, "I knew you were, but I didn't realize to what extent until now the prosecutors are bringing it out." And I said, "You didn't deserve to get hit."
Yeah.
I said, "No one deserves to get hit." And for them trying to sanction it by saying you deserved it is horrendous because there's so many victims of domestic violence, men and women, mostly women, but there's plenty of men. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that should be condoned by anyone, whether you're a prosecutor or a defense lawyer, but especially if you represent the people of the state that you're supposedly representing.
Mr. Shiner told me that Travis is one of the nicest clients he's ever represented. And from the start, he truly believed in his innocence. But he also knew he was facing an uphill battle. Defense attorneys often walk into the courtroom with the deck stacked against them. There's a natural bias. People assume that if someone is sitting in that defendant's chair, they must have done something wrong. Undoing that kind of built-in judgment takes real work. Heidi Perlet was an integral part of that work. But interestingly, she wasn't originally hired for the case. She chose to work the case pro bono because she also believed Travis was innocent. But how did she hear about it in the first place? Well, Perlet and Shiner aren't just a powerhouse legal team. They're also a power couple. The two met in 2001 while working at the prosecutor's office. And now, the married duo co-lead the law firm of Perlet and Shiner in West Palm Beach. Together, they were determined to fight for Travis. Perlet and Shiner knew how complicated Florida's self-defense law was, and that the burden lied on the prosecution. Once a defendant claims self-defense or stand your ground, the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a person was not acting in self-defense. When Mr. Shiner explained that to Travis, he said Travis knew the jury would believe his side of the story. Travis's confidence shaped the defense's strategy. They spent countless hours preparing, assigning cross-examinations based on personalities, and mapping out what evidence they'd show right from opening statements. They believed that from the very start, the jurors were open and receptive to hearing Travis's version of events. And it wasn't just the jury who had a change of heart after hearing the evidence. Mr. Shiner and Ms. Perlet told me the media presented the narrative that Travis was guilty, which prevented some people from supporting him in the beginning.
In the beginning, Travis had so many people from Cardinal Newman High School, from Florida State, NFL players, they were on the sidelines. They didn't want to support him because they believed that it's possible what the police are reporting and what the news are reporting. They stood on the sidelines. They weren't against him, but they also weren't in favor. As the trial progressed, more and more people, priests were calling us, emailing us, school teachers, people that were went to college with him, and football players and coaches all started coming and realizing, wow, there was a lot more to this story.
Yeah.
And that's great, because you know what? Maybe now people will keep their eyes open and not always believe what they hear and see in the newspaper.
For every person who may have questioned Travis's innocence, there were others who held on to the image of the man they knew him to be, the kind, empathetic football star who once sat beside a young boy with autism at lunch when no one else would. Bo Paskey was in sixth grade when Travis and the FSU football team visited his middle school. Travis noticed Bo sitting by himself in the cafeteria, grabbed a slice of pizza, and sat down to join him. Someone captured the moment in a photo that quickly went viral, spreading across social media and making national headlines. 7 years later, in a powerful, full-circle moment, 18-year-old Bo traveled with his mother, Leah, from Tallahassee to West Palm Beach, more than 6 hours away, to support the man who once supported him. Leah told CBS News she just wanted the truth to come out about what happened. And Bo, he said he was just there to support Travis. Bo and his mom sat in the front row of the courtroom. And Travis later told CBS that seeing him again after all those years put a big smile on his face. The gesture of kindness he made as a college athlete came back to him in an unexpected way, at a time he needed it most. Bo's quiet show of support was just the beginning. As the trial went on, more and more people rallied around Travis, both inside and outside the courthouse.
Travis had tons of supporters, tons of people working in the courthouse that I won't talk about and who they were, but everyone was rooting for him at the courthouse, everybody in the community that I heard. But there was such an eruption outside that a friend of mine was walking into the state attorney's office at the time this happened, and we came outside and he heard just an eruption. He didn't know what was going on of applause and people screaming for joy that Travis was let go of this and freed of the burdens of being accused of murder and attempted murder. It was all positivity.
Both Mr. Shiner and Ms. Perlet said they were flooded with emails, phone calls, and text messages about Travis's case. People were invested in the case. They wanted to offer their support and wanted the lawyers to know they were rooting for Travis.
But it brought everyone together, the whole clerk's office.
this was a unifying event. For whatever reason, there were a number of factors at play, but it really unified the community. And it wasn't Wow. just other defendants, it was law enforcement. After the trial, a letter was sent to me. It was a prosecutor from that office who wrote a handwritten note, a prosecutor who enclosed a gift card to a restaurant for the Rudolph family to go have a nice meal together to try to forget the horror that they went through and how she was cheering for us and the family and how justice had prevailed.
But regardless of how the jury and the community saw things, not everyone was pleased with the verdict.
Every county in Florida has their own state attorney that's an elected official. In this county, Dave Arenberg is the elected official, and his office put a statement out after the trial. They don't agree with the jury verdict, which I didn't think was appropriate. They shouldn't have said that. Yeah. But more importantly, they still said the hearts went out to the victims in this case and their families. And that's really disrespecting the jury's verdict because they meant the person yeah. died. And in this case, the victims, it's proven in a court of law, was my client and his family and everyone else in their family. They're the true victims.
No matter what the prosecution or Arenberg thought about the verdict, the jury's unanimous decision gave Travis his life back. Immediately following his acquittal, Travis went home and celebrated with his family. He has since been working hard to restart his football career and has spent some time playing for the XFL and Canadian Football League. He is currently a free agent, eager to return to the career that gave him so much joy. Despite setbacks, Travis remains optimistic and thankful at this second opportunity.
They're doing really well. Every time we speak to him, Travis, you know, says it's a great day. He walks out of the house, he looks up to the sky, he thanks God, and he feels blessed.
Every trial offers a central narrative, a version of events shaped by who speaks, what's admitted, and what stays hidden. But sometimes, beneath that main storyline lies another narrative, built by pieces that never make it to the courtroom. Florida versus Travis Rudolph is one of those trials. The prosecution's version of events consisted of witnesses, evidence, and a courtroom narrative they wanted the jury to believe. The defense's? Something very different. A lead detective's early mistakes, last-minute revelations, and a family's testimony that humanized Travis and showed his fear and mindset from that night. The juror's job is a heavy one, deciding which competing narrative to believe and determining what justice should look like in any given situation. What version feels more complete? The polished courtroom narratives or the messy reality? Which gives a truer sense of what really happened? In Travis's case, it seems that the hidden information supported the jury's decision. It also makes this the perfect example of how a trial acts as a mirror of how stories are told and what's withheld in the pursuit of justice. Special thanks to our guests, Mark Shiner and Heidi Perlet. Join us next week for an all-new case.